Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Damage Report. It's Friday. Thank goodness for that. Hey, Brett, how's it going?
It's going great. I'm so happy to be here today.
I'm happy to have you here.
I already ate a fast food this morning. I had a sourdough jack, which is like a lunch thing.
Yeah.
Wasn't done well.
It's a pretty intense lunch.
It was great. Last time I did that, I ate it far enough ahead of showtime where I already started feeling terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I say about 45 minutes into this show.
Yeah.
Given when I started eating it,
you're gonna start to turn green.
I will feel like death.
Okay, yeah.
I will be very slow.
You'll have matched me by then.
Ratchet up the energy at the 45 spot.
I don't know what's going on. Okay.
Dan Evans, who is in the control room right now, is on the happy half hour this week.
That is exciting news.
So tune in.
And appropriate to talk about.
And right now, take a moment, go to Bespoke Post, tyt.com/bespoke.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
sounds like
it,
fun.
Just do that.
Well, I can't wait to see that episode. I think it's gonna be a lot of fun. You know what else is gonna be fun? This episode, actually, because Donald Trump yesterday responded to some of the accusations made by Rudy Giuliani goon Lev Parnas. And so we're gonna have that for you, should be fun. We've got a couple of guests who are gonna join us. We've got some tragic news having to do with the American healthcare system. And a very clever attack on the press by a Republican. It's very clever, it's very witty. And they're gonna take a victory lap that has been well earned. So we're gonna close out the show with that. But before we get to all that, let's start off with Donald Trump. So we showed you videos yesterday of Lev Parnas on Rachel Maddow making a lot of claims about Rudy Giuliani, the Ukraine scandal, and Donald Trump, including that Donald Trump knew everything that was going on and knew Lev Parnas. Well, Donald Trump was asked about that at a meeting yesterday. It was this faith-based meeting, there were some kids there, and here's what he said.
Efforts in Ukraine were all about 2020. You just wanted Joe Biden out. What's your response?
Well, I don't know him. I don't know Parnas, other than I guess I had pictures taken, which I do with thousands of people, including people today that I didn't meet, but just met him. I don't know him at all. Don't know what he's about. Don't know where he comes from. Know nothing about him. I can only tell you this thing is a big hoax. It's a big hoax. We call it, this is the current hoax. We've gone through the Russian witch hunt. We've gone through a lot of them from probably before I came down the escalator, but certainly since I came down the escalator, you take a look at what's happened. And in the meantime, our country, it doesn't matter what he says. He's trying to probably make a deal for himself. I don't even know who this man is, but I don't know him. I had never had a conversation that I remember with him. Certainly, let me just tell you, you just have to take a look at the polls. Quiet. You just have to take a look at the pictures. You just have to take a look at the polls. You see, I don't need anybody's help.
Okay, so it wasn't really clear whether he knew him or not, so he continued.
To say it, I hope I don't sound ridiculous. I don't know who this man is. I mean, he could be walking down the street. I wouldn't know a thing. Sorry to this man.
Look, we all know what you're doing, you lying projector. We know that you needed, you probably didn't need help against Joe Biden, but you were deathly afraid of running against him and you got yourself impeached. It was a stupid, stupid own goal, but you did it. And okay, so what's interesting there though, is that when Kellyanne Conway was responding to Lev Parnas' claims about whether Donald Trump was aware of what was going on, she was very careful and would not say on the record whether he did or not. In terms of whether he even knows who this person is, Donald Trump was not backing off from that and said many times, I don't know him, I don't know who he is, I don't know his name, I don't know any of that. Does that represent new knowledge or just a willingness of Donald Trump to lie that Kellyanne Conway would not?
It's a willingness that Trump will lie because he considers it to be a strong stance, but it is a strong lying stance. Mm-hmm. It is also inherently weak because of how he freaks out when people confront him over it.
Mm-hmm.
Quiet.
Yeah.
Quiet. But he always does this. He always says, I don't know the person.
Yeah.
He always, that is his default response. He did it with Sondland. He's done it with countless other people. I don't know the guy. I don't know about this. I don't know about WikiLeaks. I don't know about anything. And so when he says stuff, when he's confronted with it, that's his default response until he has to change his tune, which has happened with all those other things and will continue to happen. And one thing that's very frustrating, and this is kind of a theme, is that he's going to tell you, and people on the right have tried to convince you, that Lev Parnas does not deserve any credibility whatsoever. There's one huge exception. There's one thing they can't make you overlook, which is Giuliani hired him.
Yeah.
Like, your team, who you have you say deserves credibility, hired this guy that by your own claims has no credibility. Mm-hmm. And then also when Trump says,
why did he do that?
And then also Trump, there's so many hoaxes. Have you ever considered that all these things that you consider to be hoaxes, maybe the fact that they keep coming up, it's actually you. They might actually be true. He wants us to believe that every single thing that comes up surrounding this guy when it comes to unethical behavior and allegations of the same, that it's all made up. Mm-hmm. But there's so many things, it can't possibly all be made up. Especially when in the impeachment trial and the impeachment hearings leading up to it, they never disputed the facts. Mm-hmm. It's all about, this isn't a big deal. That's what it ended up getting to.
Well, look, we live in a country where people have wildly differing views of the significance of events. You know, these hoaxes, obviously, he and his base see them in a very different way. But even really simple things, like you heard in that clip, he said, you know, probably even before I came down that escalator, And I think of like a guy about to announce he's running for the president gliding down an escalator is sort of a silly image. But he thinks it's like glorious.
But
he's remembering it as this great thing.
I don't even think of it as a silly image. It's like, why would anyone remember that? Mm-hmm. I was like, you have to filter it through what a ridiculous person Trump is to even potentially arrive to potentially understand what he's talking about.
Exactly.
When he said came down the escalator, I was like, at the mall? Yeah. Like the last time I went down at the airport. This guy makes everything so romanticized about him in his own mind that he means when he came down the escalator to announce he's running.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so let's get a little bit more information about this. He was also asked about one of the documents that was released by Lev Parnas, and that is Rudy Giuliani's letter talking about the full knowledge and consent of Donald Trump. So what this represents is, we were just saying, it's really weird that the Republicans are saying, it's crazy that you're talking about Lev Parnas. Why would we care about Lev Parnas when Rudy Giuliani was working with and good friends with Lev Parnas, still has barely distanced himself from him even now. And obviously Rudy Giuliani still has the full confidence of Donald Trump so far as we know. So here he is asked about Rudy Giuliani.
He wrote a letter to Zelensky requesting a private meeting, and he said it was in his capacity as private counsel to President Donald J. Trump. This was before the inauguration. Did you authorize him to write that letter? And what was your understanding of what the meeting was supposed to be about?
Well, I don't know anything about the letter, but certainly Rudy is one of the great crime fighters in the history of our country. He's certainly probably the best over the last 50 years. Frankly, he's a very legitimate guy, a very straight shooter. I didn't know about a specific letter, but if he wrote a letter, it wouldn't have been a big deal. Rudy was always in. It was very important to Rudy that I be a great president, and that's okay with me. It was very important to a lot of people because our country was going to hell.
I don't know what stuff at the end means.
I can't understand what he's talking about. And I definitely start noticing, like, behind Trump, the people, the room meet that he's using. He's like cramming more and more people into the photo opportunities so he can say, he's like diluting the total number of people he's taking photos with so he can say, really, I don't know who Lev Parnas is. There's 7 million people in this photo with me. Mm. How can I remember one that I took 7 million photos with? But like, it's so sad.
Yeah. I don't know what the end of that was about. But look, the question was important. Rudy Giuliani was over there where he should have never been. He's not a paid employee of yours. He's not a government official. Why is he over there conducting diplomacy for the United States? Why is he surrounding himself with people like Parnas and Hyde and all of those weirdos?
When I close my eyes and I ask myself, what do I believe? Mm. I believe that Donald Trump learned from the announcement of investigations into Hillary Clinton toward the end of his the campaign in 2016, he learned that that has an effect, saying that investigations are happening.
Yeah.
So he sent Rudy Giuliani and whoever the hell Rudy needed to hire, because he knows that Rudy Giuliani has mortgaged all credibility that he had in America as America's mayor in the wake of 9/11. He went and turned into the swamp creature you see before you today.
Yeah.
And he said, just go get an investigation announced. Say that they're looking into Biden. Say that they're looking into Burisma.
Yeah.
And there's two reasons that Biden's going down in the polls. One, when he stands in front of people, he can't keep it going for more than 5 minutes. But two, because of all this.
Yeah, it's probably having some of the effect that was desired.
The specter of Burisma has delivered for Trump. Yeah. And that is what he wanted. Mm-hmm. He's so simple.
Yeah.
Because it's never about substance with Trump. None of it is ever about substance. It's only about this aura of whatever something seen on TV might imply.
And we're going to have a little bit of that later on the show when we talk about his legal team.
Okay.
But I did notice one quick thing in there. There's different levels of Trump responding to something that looks really bad for him. Denying that it exists at all is one of them. But, well, if it does exist, it wouldn't be a big deal is another level. So he can't deny that the letter exists, that Rudy Giuliani was saying he was there with the full knowledge of Trump. So he then reverts to, well, if he wrote a letter, it wouldn't be a big deal. He's not actually addressing the substance of the letter. He's admitting that it's true, but he wants to wash it away. Okay, so in his meeting yesterday, Donald Trump was asked about Lev Parnas, and a lot of little weird things happened. One was, this was apparently what was happening right before he sent a pretty noteworthy tweet, which was, I just got impeached for making a perfect phone call, which should be one of those that goes down in history.
That is not what it is about.
No, but he just said that. That's what it was for. I didn't even know that making a perfect phone call was impeachable, but apparently it is.
The perfect phone call is when you call the pizza place and they say, are you still at this address and do you still want this pizza?
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, yes, you know me.
I've never had that phone call.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're a Domino's guy, but we have a local sure. place we go to. That's a perfect phone call.
Yeah.
It's the only perfect phone call that exists.
I would say a perfect phone call is brief. That's about it. So that happened. Aaron Rupar, who tweeted out he's a journalist, he tweeted out some videos of
Great.
This. He noticed one interesting thing. Maybe, I don't know if it was visible in the videos that we played earlier, but let's take a look at this screenshot. So he's got the kids there, he's got the faith leaders there. And on the desk, he's got that county level 2016 electoral map. So understand, they were not talking about the 2016 election. I can't come up with any reason they had to have that wildly distorting map of the electoral outcome of 2016. But here's the thing, it would be really sad if the president, years after that election, was to carry around a map like that and bring it up in meetings that don't have anything to do with it. That would be sad. I will submit that it's sadder that he had it there and they didn't talk about it. He just wanted to have it there.
That's his new blotter.
His new blotter. Chris Hayes said it was his blankie. It's just there to like make him more comfortable. He's surrounded by kids and religious people. How nervous are you? Why do you need to have, like, I just want to have a big picture of a celebrity I'm a fan
bro,
of. Makes me more comfortable.
But bro, you're in the White House. Like,
it's
you're
your
surrounded
room.
By the place that proves you did win that election through. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I can't wait till we get to Martha McSally so we can talk about electoral devices that give people power and a feeling of mandate.
So if you're a Trump fan, what is your explanation for that? Like, I know that you like that map because you think that land votes or something, but like, you don't think it's weird that he's just printing it out and keeping it in the Oval Office when kids are around him? That it was years ago, you don't think that that's weird? Do you think that this is weird? Because after the meeting ended, they needed to clear people out. Remember, it's kids and religious leaders. And so this woman starts running around screaming at people to leave while she's doing that. And you're gonna hear some of that in this video. Take a look at Donald Trump saying goodbye to everyone. Kids, don't scream at them. And what was that weird? Thank you.
He enunciates.
He does enunciate. Don't yell at kids and religious leaders.
Oh my God.
We lowered the volume. She was shouting at them to get out of the way.
That last little bit with her mouth in front of the video is like those things. It was like the first chain email where it was like, here's a maze that you can do. And like you have to focus really close on getting through the tight part of the maze without touching the walls.
That.
And then suddenly like a banshee leaps forward and goes, ah!
Yes. Okay, I do remember that. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, we're gonna be talking about a lot of other stuff after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un*****ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un*****ing the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
We all understand that America's healthcare system, our situation with insurance, all of this has negative outcomes for the American people. And when we talk about it, we often talk about the big numbers of people who go into medical bankruptcy, people who can't get the care they need, people who go bankrupt as a result of all of that. But let's talk about an individual. Let's put a name and a face on the way that people get left behind by our healthcare system in America. This is Tashana Ward. She's a 25-year-old in Wisconsin, and she died because of the inefficiency in the way healthcare is given to the American people. So she began to have chest pain and trouble breathing while she was working at L&M Links Child Care Center. Her sister drove her to Froder Hospital. They checked in at 4:58 p.m. and were then examined. She had a number of different symptoms in terms of her breathing, chest pain, all of that. She had previously been diagnosed as having an enlarged heart. So if that's the situation, then this is obviously bad. You don't want chest pain when you previously have a condition with your heart. You need that to be dealt with immediately. But it wasn't. After the tests, Ward's family said she was asked to stay in the waiting room until staff could provide further medical attention. The medical examiner's report does not indicate what happened after the tests, but we do have some information from her and from her family. So about an hour later, at 5:45 p.m., she posted on Facebook, "I really hope I'm not in this emergency room all night." About 45 minutes after that, she texted her family that she was still in the waiting room. About an hour after that, she wrote on Facebook that she'd been told she might have to wait 2 to 6 hours to see a doctor. She'd already been waiting hours at that point. And she posted, "I don't know what they can do about the emergency system at Froder, but they damn sure need to do something." Well, at 8:39, another hour later, Froder staff called her cell phone and her sister picked up, according to the medical examiner's report. By that point, she had collapsed and was already in an ambulance on her way back to Froder. So what happened is she waited hour after hour after hour, was not going to be treated. She was so worried about the symptoms she was experiencing that she decided to leave and go to urgent care. But she didn't make it to the urgent care because it got even worse. And so she needed to be ambulanced back to the hospital. But she didn't make it and she died. And so she did like the responsible thing that America is supposed to do. She was experiencing symptoms. She went to get care. She waited patiently hours, even though she was concerned about what those hours might represent. And in the end, she died.
That is sad. That is terrible. And I mean, I don't know what conclusions to bring from this specific instance, but it makes me think of all the things that have happened surrounding emergency room care as a result of the system that we have in America. In America, we have a system where most of the people who need health care don't have it because it's tied to your job. And if you're struggling one way in America, you struggle always. Mm-hmm. And I mean always in terms of in every possible way, and you struggle forever. And so when typically people in those situations can't get the normal general practitioner preventative care as a result of not having health insurance, then things, this is not her specific case, but typically things pile up until eventually the only way you can get care, the only place that has to take you is the emergency room.
Yeah.
So typically, and there was a Medicare for All hearing a couple months back where a New York City emergency medical care doctor communicated this. He's like, A, it's way more expensive when this happens, and B, it clogs up the emergency room.
Yeah.
Because the only place you can reliably go, and I've had HMO healthcare with the good healthcare that they do provide here at TYT. But I do the HMO because it's cheaper. And yeah. the HMO, those urgent care places, they don't, they're not all open to you.
Yeah.
And it and through and the incentives for the insurance company, private insurance company, is not to be that transparent with you as to where you can get urgent healthcare.
Yeah.
I've been in emergency room needs where I Googled hospital because they don't want to tell you where you should go.
Yeah.
They don't have any incentive. They don't have every incentive to do that the way that they would under a different system.
Yeah.
This is so tragic and so sad.
It seems so unnecessary.
Why do you tie this to the specific problems of the American healthcare system?
Well, there's a few, I would say, systemic problems in our healthcare system that thankfully have gotten some coverage at least. So I know that it's like popular in the last few years to hate on John Oliver, even Dan, our producer, hates on him. But he did a great full show about emergency rooms and the issues with emergency rooms. But also there was one, I believe it was about pain and pain management. And so we have a quote really fast. It's from the chief of cardiology, University of Arizona College of Medicine. It says, sadly, she chalks up to another statistic, but she was somebody's sister, somebody's potential mother, somebody's daughter. We need to start listening to women and taking them seriously. And what she's referring to there is that generally when women talk about pain, it has been shown through studies that doctors do not take their declarations of their pain level as seriously. And often women's concerns, their claims about their pain are not taken seriously, and that can have very negative ramifications for their health. It is possible, and by the way, there's an amplifying effect based on race as well in this area. And so that is discrimination that is baked into our healthcare system, even amongst doctors that must think that they don't have any of those sorts of medical bigotries or whatever. But how you're prioritized, they talk about triage, and of course it's triage. But how do you make those decisions? Well, if you naturally don't trust one gender or one race, then those sorts of people are going to have worse outcomes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Look, it's obviously a big topic. Unfortunately, we don't have time to talk more about it, but this is something serious. And it's like, this is just one tiny little tragic reminder of why healthcare is one of the biggest topics being discussed right now in this presidential election, justifiably so. And I wanna make sure that we do focus on it because it merits that. Okay, so let's take a short break. We got lots more to get to after this. Joining us once again on the Damage Report with an exciting new announcement, Joshua Collins. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me again.
Glad to have you here. And I know you're joining us to make an announcement. So what's going on?
We have put together a caucus of 25 socialist candidates around the country. And so today we are announcing the formation of the Rose Caucus. And when I say socialist, I mean everyone on this caucus is a socialist, not a social democrat, and we are running on a bold platform with a united vision for the future of the country.
So, so tell us about that platform. What are some of the things that connect the couple dozen candidates? What are some of the commonalities?
Well, the important thing is that we have very specific policies, over 200 of them. Some of the obvious ones, Medicare for All, a Green New Deal that, gets us to green energy with, and zero emissions by 2025. We have the federal jobs guarantee and housing guaranteed as a right. and it just goes on and on. We have a very bold platform that is extensive and explicitly states what we believe in.
So, do all of the candidates basically sign on and agree to all of these policies, or are these sorts of broad organizing principles? Is this like basically a pledge that they are signing on to?
No, they are required to adopt the entire platform.
Okay.
And that's all 200, I think 230 policies today. Yeah.
Okay. So, why you're forming a new caucus, the Rose Caucus? There are obviously some pre-existing progressive organizations, some of which have sort of platforms of their own. So what made you want to go about starting this new one? What are some of the things that distinguish it from some of the pre-existing progressive organizations?
Well, I think the number one thing is that the consideration is only given to candidates who publicly identify as socialists and align with the entire platform. None of it's negotiable. You have to adopt the platform and be a socialist, or you cannot be in. And this is a very hardline stance to further the revolutionary movement in this country.
So we've talked about your candidacy before. I mean, obviously we can't go into depth into all 24 of the candidates, but are we talking about candidates across the country running in some blue districts, some red districts? Is this being tested in a wide variety of different political contexts?
Yes, we have candidates all over the country, and 25 of them, mostly in the House of Congress. And then we also have Senate seats and state legislature seats that we're running in.
And so what I'm curious about is, we know that in the past, some of these progressive organizations that have run candidates, even some of whom who have since won and are now serving in Congress, haven't necessarily received much support from the Democratic Party. Are there any of these 24 candidates that have been picked up by the party? Or are these generally more independent candidates running without that sort of institutional support?
Both. Some candidates, it depends on the race. In some places, it's advantageous to run as a Democrat. And in some places, it's better. It's probably easier to run as an independent. Even if green candidates run, they are still welcome. It's just the requirement is that they be a socialist and they align with the entire policy platform, no exceptions.
Okay. So if people would like to find out more about the policies, you said there were quite a few. Where can they go for more information about the Rose Caucus and its candidates?
My website is joshua2020.com, and the Rose Caucus is just rosecaucus.com. And on every social media platform, it is Rose Caucus.
Okay. Well, Joshua Collins, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate learning about the Rose Caucus, and good luck to your candidates.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break here. We come back, another guest is going to join us on the other side. Joining us now is a woman running for Congress in Arizona's first district, Eva Putsova. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you here. So before we launch into your political experience, your platform, tell us a little bit about the first district.
So this is the 10th largest district in the country. It's actually three times as big as the country where I was born at, which is Slovakia. It's a solidly blue district. There are more Democrats, registered Democrats, than Republicans, and independents split proportionally. Media called it a solidly blue district. There are a lot of people like me who want to see this district to be represented by a progressive.
Okay, so as of right now, the incumbent is a Democrat, Tom O'Halloran, first elected in 2016. So what do you think makes him not a good fit for the district the way you've described it?
Well, Tom O'Halloran was a lifelong Republican. He switched parties and ran as a Democrat for the first time in 2016. He voted with Trump 54% of the time in the first cycle, in the 2018 cycle. He takes money from corporate interests. He takes money from everybody and anybody. He takes money from arms industry, from private prison industry, from financial institutions, from sugar lobby, and even from the most corrupted Arizona entity that those people in Arizona know, it's APS.
And what about you? What is your fundraising strategy? Who are you accepting money from? Who are you not fundraising from?
So we are running a completely grassroots campaign. We take money from individuals who want to see a more progressive Congress. And we refuse taking money from PACs, from corporate PACs, and of course from lobbyists.
And let's get into your background. What are you bringing to this race? What is your experience like?
So I became a U.S. citizen back in 2007. In 2014, I ran for a local city council. I got elected. I ran a local citizen initiative raising Flagstaff's minimum wage to $15.50. We also raised the wage for the tipped workers. And then I ran a campaign to defend this initiative against an attempted repeal in 2018. I got first involved in politics back in 2008 when I joined a local grassroots advocacy organization that works towards social, economic, and environmental justice. And I am the kind of candidate that supports what I think a lot of people in this country, probably majority, want, universal healthcare. I don't think anybody wants to be bankrupt because of medical bills. I support bold climate action. There's no way that we are going to get out of this climate crisis unless we completely retool our economy. And I support Green New Deal. I support Medicare for All. I support a fully publicly funded pre-K through college education, the kind of education that I actually was lucky to benefit from. My education was completely tuition-free all the way through my master's, and I want that for every single person in this country as well.
So what's interesting about this race is not just are you running against an incumbent Democrat, but there are multiple challengers. There's actually a pretty crowded field on the Republican side. So how are you differentiating yourself, not just against Tom O'Halloran, but also against these other Democrats that are running to run against him in this primary?
So as far as I know, there are four people who filed with FEC. Tom O'Halloran and I are the only candidates that actually filed finance reports with FEC. So I don't know how serious the other two candidates are. One is a conservative Democrat who is supported by NRA and the industry. And the second one I really cannot comment on because I haven't seen any materials from him, being published or being shared with voters.
So I am curious, whenever you have a case like O'Halloran, where you have someone switching parties like that, so you've described it as a very blue district. He had previously been a Republican. When you're out canvassing and you're talking with people, what do they think about him relatively recently, just a few years ago, switching to the Democratic Party?
So believe it or not, a lot of people don't actually know who is their representative. His name ID in a district is not very high. Obviously, he's known in the Democratic circles. And people don't have time to follow his votes. You know, they don't know that he voted to deregulate banks, or they don't know that he voted to criminalize immigrants and voted for this Cates law that does that. They don't know that he praised ICE or he voted. He was one of the seven Democrats. He voted to give Trump the authority to go to war with Iran without congressional approval. So a lot of voters, even those very engaged, don't actually know his actual track record, not just what he says, but what he does. We have a big challenge. Obviously, this is a large district. It's geographically giant. It's very diverse. And so we have to get our message out. And what I stand for is what I believe a majority of people want, because they're tired of inequality. They're tired of corporate money actually running our politics. And I'm the kind of candidate that would put people first, not corporations.
You know, I'm interested just because you did point out that he was one of the few Democrats to side with Republicans on that Iran vote. Is that something that you're hearing being talked about while you're out canvassing? Are people talking about how close we came to war with Iran? Is that a concern going forward for the rest of this term?
Yes, I think this past summer when that failed amendment, when he voted on that failed amendment, I don't think people quite realize just how close to being in war we are with Iran. And I think this is becoming a big issue for people in our district. Obviously, nobody wants to see young people to go dying because of our irresponsible executive branch. And so, you know, this is a problem. But of course, people are concerned about the fact that, you know, their standard of living has decreased over the decades. And even though economy is doing well based on the numbers, their own lives have not improved. And they're tired of being told about jobs, when we don't talk about what kind of jobs. Yeah. People are tired of working 2-3 jobs just to get by and have absolutely no savings, have no benefits when they retire. I think people are concerned where we're heading and how we are taking care of our communities.
And where can people go to find out more about your candidacy?
So the best way is to go to evaforcongress.com. That's EVAFOR congress.com. And I hope people can follow us on Twitter, and that's at Eva Pucová. And you can find me on Instagram. If you Google me, you'll find everything there is to find about me.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for joining us on the show today. We really do appreciate that.
Thank you for having me.
I want to take one last break here. When we come back, a Republican senator has found a way to do a little bit of fundraising off the back of a very witty attack against the media. We're going to break that down after this. Okay, I want to add a new story to our file of everything is dumb and awful. And that is Martha McSally is a senator who's handed her position in Arizona. And yesterday, she was walking through the halls of Congress and she was approached by a reporter who wanted to ask her about the impending impeachment trial. So here is the question and the response, and understand that this video was put on Twitter by her.
Senator McSally, should the Senate consider new evidence as part of the impeachment trial?
Man, you're a liberal hack.
You're not going to comment, Senator, about this?
That was CNN reporter Manu Raju. And he asked her, will you consider new evidence in the trial? Which seems like a good question, a fairly benign question.
The question.
A question.
The question. The question. To ask.
Yes.
This is the question you will be asked when walking through the halls of Congress. And the best part about it is you will realize that she is not recording this.
Yeah.
This is Martha McSally, failed Senate candidate.
Yes, she lost originally.
She ran against Kristen Sinema, and Arizona, as a state, said, nah, no thanks.
Yeah.
And she was like, should I do that weird thing that people start doing that you ended up seeing like Bevin do in Kentucky and like contest it? She was like, nah, I'll give up. Because I know I'm going to get appointed later to fill the seat of John McCain.
Which is totally allowed, but really doesn't seem right on a fundamental level.
And we'll get to the entitlement of it all. I hope you remind me in a second. But just know that she was like, oh, there's Manu. Turn on the camera. Here we go down the hallway. Make sure you get it, because I got my hack line ready.
Yeah.
You're a liberal hack, buddy.
So she delivered her hack line. And here's where it gets into everything is dumb and there's no standards for anything. So she delivers the line, which, okay, seems below, you know, what we should be able to expect from a senator. Now she is selling this shirt, you're a liberal hack buddy, from someone who has a passing interest in graphic design at best. And here is how
Design's
calculated
the
whole, design is my passion. So how fast? Well, she attacked Manu in the 10 a.m. hour. She had registered the domain name liberalhack.com by the 11 a.m. hour. So she couldn't stop to answer his question because she was too busy. Too busy registering domains to then sell t-shirts of her slam against this reporter. Who, by the way, is like, he's a CNN reporter. He isn't some like crazy wild-eyed socialist, like
he is the
essayist.
Hardest working guy at CNN, arguably. Like there's some people like Wolf Blitzer who can do like 7 hours in a row because he conserves energy. He's actually sleeping half the time he's talking. Like, hey, what is going on later in the show? I'm taking a nap right now. But Manu Raju is that guy who's going back and forth. And it's moments like this that make you realize that's exactly, no wonder the Senate wants to restrict access to reporters, because oh my God, they get so triggered when little Manu Raju asks a question like, hey, do you want to hear witnesses in a trial?
Yeah, it wasn't laced with F-bombs. It was an obvious question that and how obvious it is will be made clear very, very soon. But here is the grift, basically. One, They have shirts ready to go. They've registered it within an hour. They're selling the shirts. Two, they get an assist from the president, who of course wants sycophants in the Senate to clear him. So the Trump war room on Twitter gives three cheers and puts a donation thing. So she is there being flippant about a trial to potentially remove the president from office. She is making very clear that she doesn't care about the evidence and she's just gonna vote to support him. And so Donald Trump helps her raise money as a result of that. How is any of this legal? It is. You can do it. Seems wildly unethical and against the intent of the Constitution.
It is,
but you can do it.
But we're pointing out just how grifty and disgusting it is. Another little wrinkle in this is the Senate is now handing out cards, according to CBS, that tell you what to do. It says phrases to use when seeking assistance, which does not apply to this, but it's things to say to reporters when you're walking through the halls of the Senate. And it says, please move out of my way. You are preventing me from doing my job. Please excuse me, I'm trying to get to the Senate floor. Please excuse me, I need to get to a hearing. And please do not touch me.
Yeah. Well, the fourth one is you're a liberal hack, buddy.
None of them are you're a liberal hack.
That must be a different card.
So we need to point, we're pointing out the grift, how transparent it is, how obvious. I also need to point out that Gabby Gifford's husband is running against her. Please, everybody, have her lose twice.
Yeah.
Let's have her lose this Senate thing twice.
That would be great.
Yeah.
And so here is one of the things that bothers me. Not just that it's wildly unethical that she's like coordinating in this way with Donald Trump, who they're supposed to be considering the evidence against. It's how low the bar is. Like, so she got asked a benign question and she yelled at him, you're a liberal hack, buddy, which, like, you could just yell stuff, I guess. That doesn't make it clever. But all of her supporters think you aced that thing. Great slam, great burn. And I want you to see, when I'm really not exaggerating this. I want you to see how happy with herself she is. Here she is last night on Laura Ingraham.
Love it.
Senator, do you regret what you said?
No, Laura, I do not. And I said it again, actually, as I went in. I said, you're a liberal hack, buddy.
Okay. I don't regret it. I said it again. You called him a little. Okay. Why are you so proud of yourself? And the thing is, she is basically Charlie Kirk, but a senator. She's Ben Shapiro, but an elected office. They are pandering to dumb, incurious, unfunny people who accept anything aggressive against the left as like the height of political philosophy and ideology.
But it wasn't against the left, it was against Manu Raju. Well,
against
who just
even
goes,
someone who's being implied to be on the left. He's just a CNN reporter.
But the best part about this is she thought she would get a pat on the back from Laura Ingraham.
I mean.
And she doesn't.
Well, she doesn't. Okay, so why don't we go. She gets booked, but yes, not a real pat. So it's an unfair question. It's a trapping question to ask her about the evidence. So here is Laura Ingraham asking the exact same question.
Do you want witnesses, yes or no? Why aren't you telling us?
Because we're gonna vote on Tuesday to start the trial and let them present the
But how are you gonna vote on the motion for more for witnesses?
We're gonna get to that. I mean, I'm not gonna tell everybody what all my votes are gonna be, but obviously my point.
Pretty easy question, don't you think, Senator?
I think we're gonna proceed forward at that point.
Yep, and Ingram's smart that way. She's like, you can't grift me, bud.
Yeah.
Don't grift a grifter, can't slick a can of oil.
Laura Ingraham, liberal hack.
But
yeah,
that's
it's
it.
An obvious question we wanted the answer to. Just answer the question. But, why are you being so weird?
But watch McSally implode. You just saw her implode when having to think for herself on her feet.
Yeah,
because she thinks that she has insulated herself so much from ever having to answer a question.
Yeah.
Just by saying yes and getting under Trump. It didn't work for you in her first Senate campaign, and it won't work again.
I hope so. That would be a nice end to this story. Okay, thank you for joining us throughout the week. Brett, thank you. Watch Happy Half Hour later today with Dan from the internet's gonna be on. Should be a lot of fun. I'll see you later on today on the main show. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.